shortly, dear listeners, Dennis Atkins, Laura Tingle, Richard Das and Paul Collins will be joining me for the last live, late night live of the year before we go into our summer seasons of repeats. But before we do that, I want to do what one normally does at the end of the last program. I want to roll the credits and thank the team. I do this because you do not begin to understand, dear listener, the immense contributions of my lovely colleagues and how we get the program to air every night, 2-3 stories a night forever, verges on the miraculous. It's a very, very hard task. The program is an omnivore and it gobbles up vast amounts of material, and yet, night after night, often, you know, great risk and difficulty, we're there. And to that end, I'd like to thank my producers, Anne Arnold, Mudita Dias, Christine Short, and my beloved executive producer, Gail Basario. Gail not only produces the program, but she pretty much produces me. I've given up making decisions in my life. Gail has now taken over. And as well as putting out these umpteen programs, she put an immense amount of effort into our sort of archival website In Bed with Philip, which I commend to your attention. That's oodles of the best interviews that we've done over the last 21 years. Technically, I pay tribute to Paul Gough, known affectionately around the place as Paulie Pies. It's a privilege, a pleasure and an honour to work with the team and this ageing and dilapidated broadcaster. Thanks you from the bottom of his pacemaker heart. Tonight, that distinguished panel I mentioned looks at the ramification of what's happened over the past year, to what extent has the country changed, if at all, and what's to come next year in the world and locally via what looks like an Abbott-led government. Yes, we will mingle with Tingle, Laura, our former regular political editor with the Australian Fin Review. Lovely to have you back, Laura. With me in Sydney is Das, a former banker and author of Extreme Money and Traders, Guns and Money, and of course our in-house economics whiz. Our friend Dr. Paul Collins, historian, former Catholic priest and ABC broadcaster. Paul's the author of Papal Power and more recently God's New Man and Burn, the epic story of bushfire in Australia, all of which we've discussed on the program at one time or another. In our Brisbane studio is Dennis Atkins. Dennis is a national affairs editor with the Courier Mail, a regular on ABC TV's Insiders program. Welcome, Dennis.
Welcome, Philip. Thank you.
One of the first big things to happen this year, Dennis, was Rudd's leadership challenge way back in February, followed quickly by the Queensland election with that landslide win by Campbell Newman. Did Kev's challenge have anything to do with the death of Anna Bligh's chances?
Well, it didn't help. The two events sort of merged into one in a sense, in that I think Kevin Rudd was probably thinking about a challenge to the leadership of the Labor Party after the Queensland election. However, Julia Gillard, Wayne Swan and others had other ideas, and they put all sorts of pressure on, one way or another, fair or foul, and smoked him out and made him go sooner than he would have liked. Now, this not only was a disaster for Rudd in that he failed to get anywhere near enough numbers to even have a respectable loss, but also it blew away the first week of Anna Bligh's campaign. And Anna Bligh was planning to use Kevin Rudd heavily in the campaign, and she did use him a bit, but I think not only did she lose that first week when the Labor Party was planning to sort of lay some groundwork for some assaults on Campbell Newman, but she also, the power of having Kevin on the hustings was diminished a bit. And generally, because Kevin Rudd is so popular in Queensland, a lot of people, especially some wavering Labor voters, didn't like being reminded that the Labor Party had rejected Kevin Rudd not once but twice, and this just made them even more sour on the party. So all of those events sort of came together. It certainly didn't help Anna Bligh. I think she was gone anyway, but it probably did make it a bit worse.
Dennis, when the New South Wales Labor government was chucked into outer darkness, it didn't seem to me to be chucked far enough. But did Bligh's government deserve to be so energetically disposed of? Was it that bad?
Well, it wasn't bad in the same way that the New South Wales Labor government was. I think that the problem for the Labor government up here, and members of the government knew this, and that was that it was seen as being incompetent. And there were some pretty graphic examples, such as the payroll bungle for Queensland Health, where doctors and nurses at hospitals weren't getting paid or weren't getting paid properly for up to 12 months. And this is a bungle that's ended up costing the taxpayer about $1.5 billion just for not being able to put a computer system in that actually worked. So that was the most graphic example, but there were plenty of others. And, they didn't deserve the kind of punishment that New South Wales got, but for a whole lot of factors, they ended up getting it worse. And I think the thing that really sort of pushed the landslide into record territory was the Labor's campaign attacking Campbell Newman, alleging that there was something dodgy about him and his family, blowing up in their face, and that just sent it over the edge.
Now, Dennis, the honeymoon period didn't last that long for Newman, did it? Because in rapid succession, he loses three members, all the problems with Palmer and Catter. What shape are they in? Let's hypothesise, were there to be another election in the not-too-distant, would they romp in or have a bit of a battle?
They'd win pretty comfortably still. I mean, Labor has managed to rehabilitate itself in Queensland in a way that Labor hasn't been able to do in New South Wales. And that's mainly because of Campbell Newman and the sort of the fumbling and the bad communications, the bad policy, the bad politics that's occurred over the last 8 months. I've often said in recent weeks that, you know, the LNP in Queensland, Campbell Newman and his team, had a good 12 months' notice that they were not just going to win, but they were going to win very, very comfortably. But ever since the end of March, when they did win with that huge majority, they haven't behaved like a government that was prepared for office. They look more like a mob of people who just walked in off the street. And the public don't like what they've done. They don't understand a lot of the measures that have been taken. And then there have been two ministers who have been forced to resign. And as you said, three backbenchers have quit the party and gone off to join Bob Catter or are cuddling up with Clive Palmer. This is all a very bad look. And as a result...
So is the thought of cuddling up with Clive Palmer. I wish you'd phrase that differently.
Well, he's got a big dinosaur up at Coolum. Perhaps he cuddles up with the dinosaur.
Okay, now, Dus, we've seen support for major parties collapsing thither and yon, haven't we, around the world?
Well, it has been the case, certainly in Europe, because if you actually look at most of Europe, what we now see is that the two major or three major parties are polling less than 50%. And what we're seeing is a complete disillusionment with the mainstream of politics. Interestingly, in Australia, we don't seem to see that. And I think that's going to be a real problem in Europe in terms of resolving its economic problems, because I don't think you'll get a majority in many of these elections. You'll get unwieldy coalitions. And you can see that in Italy. Italy is actually fascinating because, firstly, Silvio Berlusconi's come back, which is sort of, I think this is if John Howard was Lazarus with the triple bypass, I don't quite know what Berlusconi is.
There's nothing remotely similar between Berlusconi and John Howard.
Certainly, I can't see John Howard at a bunga bunga party, so no, I think that's probably true.
Well, if he's had them, they've been incredibly discreet.
And boring, probably.
Now, Dus, you think we're avoiding, in this country, the important issue of whether we can afford the state and the structures we already have?
Well, I think it's actually fascinating because what the problems in Europe and elsewhere in the world has highlighted to me is the fact that we have governments providing and people in the populace expecting certain services, certain levels of things. Now, there's nothing wrong with that as long as you have a taxation system which matches that. Unfortunately, we want Swedish benefits, which, you know, basically American taxes, and that doesn't work. And, you know, people criticize the United States, where the taxation revenue as a percentage of what they produce is actually lower than Greece's. But we want that type of taxation system. And that's where I think the tension is.
So you'd run the line that the government can't afford the health care it's promised, it can't afford disability insurance scheme. And what about superannuation?
Well, I think firstly I'd say I just qualify that by saying you can afford to do that, but you have to change the revenue side of the equation. So you're going to have to tax people more, and they're going to have to pay for more of that. But the superannuation scheme, I think in the coming years, in 2013, 2014, going forwards, the superannuation thing will blow up magnificently because people forget what actually happened. Because previously, somebody else took the risk of your retirement and how long you lived, which was your employer or the government who agreed to pay you a pension based on some formula. But what under the Labour Party in the 80s happened was that was moved, that risk was moved from the company and the government to the individual, which there's nothing wrong with. But for 30 years, high rates of returns on investments have underwritten that entire system. And I think what people are realising is they won't be able to afford the retirement they thought they could based on the existing system, which is riddled with anomalies and tax subsidies and all sorts of things. And I think that issue is going to become a hugely political one in Australia as time goes on.
Laura, what do you think about Dass's point about government funding? Is Gillard talking about the need for tough economic medicine ahead?
Well, I think she is, Philip. I mean, it hasn't been an attractive year, but she's finished it at a point where they're going to have to start next year, which is a very simple message. Going to the point about super, or going back to my essay about expectations of government, which makes the same point. The Prime Minister's response to that is to sort of start saying, we're going to have to make choices about what we do. Now, that sort of sounds like a fairly simple formulation, but it is something that Labor can actually, if it shows a bit more political agility than it has shown a lot in the last 4 or 5 years, it can actually work this argument to its benefit. That is, it can say, right, well, we've got the National Disability Insurance Scheme. It's going to cost 30 gazillion Brazilian dollars. And obviously, we don't have the money for it. So we are going to cut back on some things which people won't like. And it might be superannuation tax concessions, or it might be, you know, the baby bonus. I don't know. I mean, all sorts of things. But super's got to be in the frame. Make a virtue out of looking like they're making tough decisions, but saying to people, well, you've got a choice to make. And in the process of doing that, I think the interesting thing is really going back to a bit of a divide in politics about government, away from everybody agreeing that we should have a surplus and not spending lots of money. I think Labor will say, it is difficult to fund what we want to do, but we will be making these mandate issues for the next election. And by the way, Tony Abbott, how are you going to fund what you're doing? Because you say you're going to fund the NDIS as well, but what choice are you going to have to make? And I think, you know, potentially we can see a broadening out of the political spectrum of arguments. Now, the political problem for the Prime Minister in that is, while she's been doing a much better job of late rebuilding Labor's base, the people she's got to attract in an electoral sense are the people in the middle who might not like those choices at all.
Well, let's look at this from another angle. Dennis has just reminded us of Rudd's self-immolation in February. Mm. And the overarching political reality of this year in Australian politics has been the story of Gillard's survival.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, just think about how, you know, 2011 finished the parliamentary year with the government making the questionable decision about putting Peter Slipper in the Speaker's chair, giving itself that extra vote when the whole question of Andrew Wilkie and his gambling reforms and Craig Thompson made it all seem a bit perilous. I think, so we've gone from this position of uncertainty where any day Tony Abbott kept telling us that the government would fall, and people essentially believed that, and Labor's primary vote went down into the absolute chasms. Kevin Rudd was a threat before and after his leadership challenges. At the end of the year, Julia Gillard is still there, the news poll in the last couple of days has raised some new questions, but nonetheless, she's basically seen them both off. They are now diminished threats. They're not obviously going to go away. The chances are that Tony Abbott will still win the election. There's still vague hopes amongst the Rudd supporters that he may be called back to duty, but she has survived.
Well, Gillard's initial ideal in politics revolved around education. What would she want her legacy to be apart from survival?
I think we're starting to see a bit more of that because the agenda started to clear out a little bit. I think she would like to see the Gonski reforms and this vision of of educational excellence be her legacy. I think there is actually, as the year finishes, a bigger question about whether we will get to anywhere near Gonski by the time of the next election than there is over the National Disability Insurance Scheme, because there just ain't the money around and she's going to need the states to help her.
We're looking at the year that was on LNL on RN, and let's now bring Dr. Paul Collins into our discussion. Paul, the world's first and greatest multinational corporation, the church of which you were previously a priest, has had a lot of practice in management, but it does seem to have sort of faltered a little lately. Cardinal Pell, for example, has been relieved of his duties of speaking on behalf of the church on matters to do with child sexual assault. Putting the Vatican to one side, what's your report card on Pell?
Well, firstly, Philip, I want to disabuse you of the thought that the Catholic Church is a very well-managed institution. It was a well-managed institution in the 17th century, and it's still operating according to the norms of the 17th century. So
that's
it's
Pope
not,
Norm. He was one of my favourites.
That's right, Pope Norm, yes. I just want to kind of demolish this myth that the Catholic Church is an extremely well-managed organisation. It's, in fact, an extremely badly managed organisation, and its structure is an enormous part of the problem. The report card on Pell. Well, of course, he was never the spokesman for the bishops. That was a role that he assumed himself. If the bishops have a spokesman, that person would be the president of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference, which up until earlier this year was Archbishop Philip Wilson of Adelaide and is now Archbishop Dennis Hart of Melbourne.
Well, they've both been well and truly eclipsed by Pell, haven't they, in terms of public perception?
Well, they certainly have. I mean, Pell, of course, has his own media organisation. His advisor is Katrina Lee. And he really, I think, in his last press conference, his role as a spokesman in any way for the Catholic Church in Australia, I think, was completely destroyed. It's a campaign I've been carrying on with ABC broadcasters for years. I've been trying to say to them, he is not the head of the Catholic Church in Australia. His authority ceases.
Hang on, I'm just writing that down. Well, he is
not the head of the Catholic Church in Australia.
Well, where is the head of the Catholic Church then? What country?
Well, that's the interesting thing that the lawyers have found out, that there really isn't one. If there is any spokesman, it is in fact the president of the Bishops' Conference. So Pell's authority ceases at the borders of his diocese. But I think that last press conference...
Some of us think that even that gives him far too much latitude.
Well, the other thing you have to take into account is that he kind of visits Australia periodically at the present moment. He's overseas. He's in Rome at present. He has been to Glasgow, where he gave a speech. There's some speculation around just at the present moment as to what he might be doing in Rome. Is he there trying to make the Vatican aware of what's going on with regard to the Royal Commission? Or is he there to look for a comfortable job for the last of his active years? I suspect that he won't leave Sydney. I think he's a very strong, tough street fighter. He's not going to run out easily, I don't think. But because at the present moment, right up until now, there was in fact just 2 days ago a papal nuncio appointed, because the Vatican has not had a man in Canberra watching what's going on in the church here and reporting it to Rome. As I said, someone was appointed, actually a British archbishop named Gallagher was appointed as papal nuncio. Pell would be the main source that the Vatican has. So for him, I don't think it's been a particularly good year. For the Catholic Church, it's been an absolutely disastrous year.
But you give at least a diagonal nod of approval to the bishops' conference, don't you? Because they haven't or tried to involve the laity in their Truth, Justice and Healing Council.
Well, yes, they've certainly done that, and the appointment, I think, of Francis Sullivan as the executive officer of that committee that they've pulled together. I mean, those who've been around the media for a while would know that Francis is a very able media performer when he was at Catholic hospitals. We haven't seen him so much when he was with the AMA, but now that he's got this job, I think he will, I hope, be back in the media. But I mean, I think we've got to remember that there are still a very large number of committed Catholics around Australia. I mean, if you just took it on mass practice, about 650,000 people go to mass every Sunday across Australia. And many of those people feel that the institutional church has failed them and has alienated them through its emphasis on power, if you like, on hierarchy, its discrimination against women, its lack of accountability, its poor governance structures. And so I think that what the Royal Commission does is it's giving committed Catholics, I think, a chance to be able to kind of point out the institutional problems, that the problems of accountability and institution, which are at the core of the church's problem and at the core of the sexual abuse crisis.
But you make a fascinating point elsewhere that in Italian there is no word for accountability. They talk about responsibility, which, of course, is a very different thing.
Yes, that's correct, although I'm always very cautious about this because there'll be, for sure, an expert Italian scholar listening, and I'll find that I'm wrong. But as I understand it, at any rate, there is a word, responsabilità, in Italian, which means responsibility. But responsibility is what you and I are expected to do. Accountability is when people in power have to answer for their actions. And that notion is, I think, totally lacking in Latin cultures generally, because I think they still live with a very old-style Catholic notion that somehow or other the clergy and the bishops and the Pope are above all judgment.
Thus, yes, speak on the Catholic Church in the US.
Well, it's actually fascinating. You were talking about the fact that it's a very ancient sort of management structure, but they actually sometimes resort to very modern techniques, because as I understand it, in the United States, the Catholic Church has taken some extraordinary measures to isolate its financial assets against the risk of litigation and claims against that by people who are obviously adversely affected by sexual
assault. They put them at the bottom of a harbour or something.
Well, it is sort of the bottom of the harbour, but it went before a judge. I think it's in Boston, and the judge made some fairly...
Very good harbour in Boston.
Absolutely, and he made some very, very acidic comments about the extent to which what was a religious organisation was doing certain things to basically move assets outside the threat of litigation. He found it quite... I don't know why he found it deplorable, but one of the lawyers I was talking to said that he hasn't seen this since Al Capone and people like Enron and so forth, which is quite extraordinary.
The high Australian dollar. You think we are no longer competitive or productive?
Well, I think fundamentally the Australian economy since the global financial crisis has cruised along on the minerals boom, which was always going to be a short-lived one. And I find it quite funny, everybody was talking about a 20-year super boom and so forth. Then suddenly 12 months later, everybody goes, there's no boom, which is kind of amusing. But fundamentally what it did was change certain things about Australia, one of which was obviously the high dollar. And the mining boom is only one part of it, but there's a whole bunch of things that it flows from the high dollar. And I don't think the dollar's going to come off very significantly for a prolonged period of time, which means our manufacturing, our industries like education exports, health exports, tourism become uncompetitive. But also the minerals boom had a really bad effect because there was enormous shortages in that area. So all our cost structures pushed up and we had massive cost overruns in those. So we've become uncompetitive.
I've got a note here that at some point you've observed that we're going to have to start getting 16 times more productive in order to compete with Hong Kong, China and even the UK.
Well, Philip, it's actually quite a funny story. There's somebody at a government entity that I saw speak at a conference, and he kept talking about structural change, and I counted. He said that 16 times in about 25 minutes. So at the end of the conference, I went up to him. I didn't want to embarrass by asking at an open forum. I said, you know, the structural change that you're talking about, what exactly is it? And he sort of faffed around for a while and he couldn't come up. I said, perhaps I can help you. And I said, and he said, yes, well, what do you think? And I said, well, Australian average wage, minimum wages are about $15, $16. US is about $7 or $8. And in China and in Hong Kong, it's about $1 to $2. So I said, we have to be basically either 16 times more efficient than Hong Kong.
Ah, right.
And he looked at me like saying, no, that's not what I mean. And I said, well, what do you mean? And it was kind of an interesting, surreal discussion because to me, our wages, and it goes back to the entitlements we have and the way our entire society and economy is actually structured. And these disparities we've carried for a long period of time. But now, in an environment which is far more stressed with lower growth, more difficulties, are being ruthlessly exposed.
Das, I spent many, many years involved in marketing a great variety of large Australian businesses. And at the time, in this, what we now allege was the heyday of Australian sort of managerial energy and production skills, I couldn't see much evidence that we ever had a good manufacturing industry.
No, I agree with you. I don't think we've ever had a great manufacturing industry. Most of it was behind subsidies and tariffs and all sorts of things. And through the 80s, as those were removed, we basically became less and less competitive. And part of that, to be very fair, Philip, was part of the globalized economy where you did what you were good at and we were good at digging things out of the ground and sending them elsewhere. And
okay, Laura, respond to that. You as, you know, as unhappy about the state of play, past, present and future, as Das?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, Philip, is that the biggest constraint on the Australian economy, which of course is actually going much better than most economies in the world, is the high Australian dollar. But I was struck by this last week when I went to a conference of market economists because they were all saying, well, the Australian dollar is basically making all of the other economic policies that the government runs not very efficient, which is a polite way of saying they're not working. And I think the interesting thing is because neither side of politics really can or knows what to do about the high dollar, it's not on the political agenda anymore. I mean, 12 months ago there was a discussion about the high dollar. Now there isn't. So we sort of have this sort of vaguely surreal conversation about whether a surplus of $1 billion or a deficit of $5 billion will change the destiny of the nation. But the biggest thing without doubt affecting the Australian economy, whether it's manufacturing and those structural changes or whether it's just whether the economy is growing fast enough or not and whether we can do anything about that, it's all completely dominated by the high dollar.
Dennis, where do you stand on this issue of the dollar?
Well, it is going to be interesting, and it's interesting what you and Das were talking about our manufacturing industry and whether or not we've ever had one that can compete and perform on its own, or whether it does need tariff walls and subsidies and other forms of government assistance. A few months ago, Innes Willicks from the Australian Industry Group and Dave Oliver from the ACTU presented a report to the government on challenges for the manufacturing sector. Now, the government's going to respond to this, as I understand, at the beginning of next year. This is going to be sort of one of the launch policies for Gillard and her industry minister, Greg Combe, very early in February, and they plan to use it to try and reconnect with those working class blokes who have turned off Gillard and Labor for a variety of reasons. So in this climate of where we've got such a high dollar and a dollar that's not going to come down without any direct Reserve Bank and government intervention, which isn't going to happen. No one wants to talk about it, as Laura said. So that's not going to happen. The dollar's going to stay up, and the international economic climate is going to keep it up there. What will the government do? I think it's going to be fascinating to watch them and see what they come up with. Will they just sort of rehash some of the old policies from the 70s and 80s of, you know, a bit of industry assistance here, a bit of subsidy there, you know, or will they actually come up with something bright and new? Dass's comment about when he was at the conference and the guy kept on talking about structural change and didn't really know what it means doesn't really sort of fill you with much confidence that it's going to be fresh and new, does it?
I was going to bring Paul Collins in at this point. The manufacturing industries in the Vatican aren't all that impressive, although it is a factory of faith. Rather than that,
can I say something?
It really hasn't been the same since Pope Norm's time. I don't know.
That's right.
But perhaps the power of prayer could be brought into this equation as well.
Now, I think the Tibetans used to drive their economy with prayer wheels. Dass, back to you. Right of reply.
Well, one of the interesting things that nobody seems to be talking about is the fact that the Reserve Bank is actually already intervening, because to my mind, the interest rate cuts that we've seen have almost minimal effect on the real economy in Australia. It's not doing much for the domestic economy. And it seems to me the Reserve Bank is actually focused on trying to at least stop the dollar going up, if not bring it down. And I think that's one of the things that I certainly think Glenn Stevens is very coy about that, because he doesn't want to be seen to try to be manipulating the dollar. And also the Reserve Bank, if you look at their balance sheet, have been intervening on and off. So it is obviously a concern, but I think there's a fundamental point here, which is Australia is a very open economy, and to some extent we are, despite certain people's views, not the largest economy in the world. So we're like a cork on a large ocean, and those flows are going to affect us, and we're going to have to live with them. And I think those internal things that we have to change are really difficult. And just talking about things like structural change and talking about things like the Asian century ain't going to cut it, in my view.
Now, I'm going to bring you back in at this point, Paul, because you and I will both miss Cardinal Pell's compelling contributions to the climate change debate. At this point of the program, we're going to move on to matters environmental. Why are you disappointed, Paul, in the performance of the Greens?
Well, just before I answer that, I was trying to get in because as I listened to Laura, Dass and Dennis, they're all theorists who are presumably paid by large media organizations or economic organizations. I'm actually an exporter. So for me, the high dollar is a disaster. I sell books overseas. And the fact that you lose, when you sell a book in the United States, the fact that you lose, 5 cents in the dollar before you even begin, let alone paying agency fees, U.S. withholding tax, and goodness knows what else, it really does affect you. And
you'll have to write shorter books, Paul. That's the only answer.
It is the only answer. Okay, why am I disappointed with the Greens? Well, I'm disappointed with the Greens because they don't seem to be interested in green issues. I confess here that, and they say confession is good for the soul. Well, I confess here that I'm a fully paid up member of the Greens, so I don't speak as someone from outside the tent, but from within it. But I think that in their attempts to mainstream themselves and to make themselves attractive to a broader cross-section of the Australian citizenry, I think that they have in many ways lost their focus on the environment. I think that there are a number of factors working within the Greens which I increasingly find difficult to deal with. To begin with, it's very interesting. Every member of the Greens gets a chance to vote on who will be the candidates for coming elections, and that's an admirable thing. I'm sure, you know, I wonder if the Labor Party could ever get around to doing that. But the problem is that often you are faced with a number of candidates whose average age is 25. Now, when you're 72, you do think, it may be an illusion, that you have learnt a few things and you may know a little. So I think that not only have they in many ways retreated from facing up to very hard environmental issues, I think also they are increasingly becoming unrepresentative in terms of the people that they are putting up for election. Now, that may sound like a rather jaundiced view, and to some extent it is.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to ask you, Laura, whether you feel the government is losing momentum or indeed interest on matters environmental. Climate change does seem to be, shall we say, understated.
Yes, Philip. Just for the purposes of natural flow from what Paul was saying, I suppose I would observe about the Greens that Labor has gone from being sort of wedged between the Greens and the Coalition, if you like, to being able to sort of move back to the left, because the Greens have sort of subsided a bit. But on the question of their environmental policies, well, I don't know. It depends which ones you choose. I mean, one sort of interesting transition, if you like, is that Greg Combe, who is both Minister for Climate Change and Minister for the sorts of industry policy issues that Dennis was talking about a little while ago, has basically shifted all the responsibility for climate change to his Parliamentary Secretary, Mark Dreyfus, and is now just concentrating on industry. Now, that might be a sign of the times, but in the government's defence, Tony Burke has landed a deal on the Murray-Darling Basin, very imperfect as it is, in the last few months, after essentially 5 years of, you know, haggling between the Commonwealth and the states. They've landed a deal on forestry. You know, there are a few things that they can point to and say, well, look, we've actually got somewhere on these things.
What do you think, Dennis?
Well, I think Laura's right. The government has made some achievements, especially with Tony Burke. But the thing that about this government that strikes me is I can't remember a government for a long time which has talked less about the environment. I mean, when they get big environmental policies like their marine parks, like the Murray-Darling and like the forestry deal in Tasmania, they're talked about either in very defensive terms of, well, this isn't really going to stop everybody from fishing, or in economic terms about, you know, this isn't really going to close down your town or your farming operation or whatever. Climate change is a classic example. This was presented by Kevin Rudd and is still presented by a number of world leaders as being a great environmental and existential challenge to the planet. And yet we discuss it in Australia in purely economic terms. This government has given away the argument of doing something about climate change for environmental benefit. All they talk about is, okay, well, it's not going to have a big economic impact, and anyway, we're going to shell out all this money to compensate you for the impact that's not going to really be there. I mean, if you remember back to the Hawke government, to the Keating government, and even to John Howard, when they had big environmental outcomes to talk about, they were quite proud of going out there and selling them.
This hanging a tree.
Yeah, exactly. And this planting a million trees, as Bob Hawke decided to do. But this government retreats from, you know, parading its green credentials, and at a time when the Greens are sort of giving away some of the ground, it strikes me as just a bit passing strange. If they want to get back some of those voters they lost to the Greens, it would seem a natural thing to do to fly your environmental flag.
Paul, you and I over the years have often bewailed or bemoaned the lack of energy from the religious parts of our consciousness on environmental issues. But religious people do seem to be making a late return into the crusading.
Well, that's true to some extent. It's certainly true in the United States, where even quite evangelical people at the, if you like, at the biblical, the very strongly biblical evangelical end of the spectrum increasingly are involving themselves in environmental issues. But that's less so, I think, in Australia. I think the thing that often cripples religious people in approaching green issues is the kind of anthropocentrism that is so dominant within the Christian tradition. And it's very, very difficult.
Yes, the world is here. All those animals and birds and creatures are here for the man's...
For us. Exactly. And I think that until the church can get beyond that, I think the other issue that churches find almost impossible to deal with is the population issue. I mean, this is another criticism I'd have of the Greens, that they have completely ignored the question of a sustainable population for Australia, let alone the question of world overpopulation. And so, for religious people, that's a very, very difficult one. I've had a go at it in a couple of books, but... It's not one that religious people find easy, and it comes back to their kind of, unnecessary anthropocentrism, because you can see the whole world, if you like, as a symbol of the transcendent. You don't have to just see humankind as that symbol.
Dennis, David Marr reckons that Abbott thrives on chaos and conflict. Well, that's pretty patently obvious. Part fighter, part charmer. How's he going to go as a hypothetical prime minister?
Well, it is going to be fascinating. I mean, it's the question that I find I'm getting increasingly asked, and I know my colleagues are as well. You know, what sort of prime minister will Tony Abbott make? If you sit down with a group of business people, it'll come up pretty quickly. They want to know what you think, because they can't get a handle on it. And these are people who actually deal with him in his office quite regularly, and they say, we have conversations with him, we talk to him, but we come away sort of knowing what transactions he's got in mind between us and a future coalition government, but we don't really know what will drive the guy if he becomes Prime Minister.
Well, one of the things that drives him, Paul, is, of course, his Catholicism. The other day, would you believe, Paul, I finally cracked it for Raheen. I was invited there to do a fundraiser for a drug organisation. When I say a drug organisation, I mean a drug education organisation. And suddenly memories came rushing back of Santa Maria, the DLP, etc., etc. Very important, Santa Maria, on Abbott's theological thinking, isn't it?
Yes, I wrote an article about that in Eureka Street about 12 or 18 months ago. It got a very vigorous response. But I do think that he himself has quite openly admitted that Santa Maria in some ways is his mentor. I think it's also true that he's quite close to Cardinal George Pell. There's no doubt about that. But I do think that we do tend to exaggerate the influence of Catholicism on Abbott. I mean, one of the things Australian Catholics have always been able to do is to have a quite schizophrenic relationship between their politics and their religion. And
Keating, I think, demonstrated that quite clearly.
Oh, absolutely, and quite a number of others. So I wouldn't want to ride the Catholic thing to death with regard to Abbott. I think he's a much more pragmatic politician than that. I think he might be rock solid on some of those moral issues that he thinks are absolutely central, but I think we might find that he's a far more pragmatic politician than we gave him credit for.
What do you think, Laura? Would he be a pragmatic prime minister, or would he be driven?
Well, he's always said, Philip, that he put pragmatism before policy purity, and I think everything we've seen of him since 2009 suggests that's the case. But I think he does remain such an absolute blank space in a way, because everything is expressed in terms of what he won't do. I mean, even yesterday he was out. He does a press conference with Joe Hockey to attack the government about the surplus, and manages to say absolutely nothing about what the coalition's position would be on the budget generally, whether he thinks surpluses are a good idea, even though he's attacking the government for crab walking away from it. I think the thing that's been, apart from anything else that's been going on this year, the really galvanising thing to watch over the last 3 or 4 months, as Labor's made something of a recovery in the polls, is Tony Abbott's incapacity to really change gear.
This is our rundown on the year that was on LNL, on RN. It's the economy, stupid. So, Das, what is going to happen globally in your view?
Well, I think you have to look at it very simply. And you look at Europe, Europe's a mess. It's not going to change. And at the moment, they're doing nothing. They're just managing to the German and Italian elections. And after that, it'll just implode into a long period of stagnation as they deal with these problems very gradually in a very slow, measured way. The US is growing, but modestly. Japan, the word growth has disappeared from the Japanese vocabulary for 20-odd years, and it's not coming back anytime soon. And, you know, the old joke that Lula had is, you know, you meet one Japanese prime minister in the morning, you can meet the next one in the afternoon, is going on. They've had six prime ministers in 5 years. Now, between those three blocks, you're talking about roughly 65-70% of the global economy.
But you're not talking about China.
China, I think, will stay quite stable because essentially they've had the leadership transition and the existing or the outgoing leadership will not want to see their legacy tarnished in the short term. They're basically pumping money into the economy to keep it going for a little bit. But the issues haven't been dealt with there either.
There is, of course, another billion-plus society, and that's India. And yet we very rarely talk about India when we're discussing the international economy.
Well, I think India is much more inward-looking. That's probably one of the reasons we don't talk about it. The second thing is it's actually a basket case on a bigger scale than China. And effectively, we've seen their growth peel off from 9% to about 5%. They have to borrow heavily from overseas. Their budget's a mess. Politically, it's a mess. But the other one of the BRICS, Brazil, growth has gone to zero. Russia's dependent on oil prices. So if you look around the world, it's a pretty bleak picture. And I would go on to say a couple of things, which I think is really important. I think to my mind, the prime thing about 2012 was the year in which Australia realized that it wasn't, A, immune from the effects of the global financial crisis, so-called, and the fact that the China story wasn't going to go on forever in the way that we'd expected. But the second thing is, everybody around the world will have to come to terms with the fact that our expectations of high growth aren't going to be realized. And the second thing is that we'll see that everybody will realize the impotence of policymakers and policies, that we can't do much about it anymore.
I'm very pleased that the world comes to an end on, I think, December the 21st, thanks to the Mayan calendar. If by any chance we happen to linger on, how concerned are you by the fiscal cliff?
That was
foretold, of course, in the Mayan calendar, as you know.
Indeed it was. And they actually identified both Obama and Boehner as being the people who would be dealing with it. It's remarkably prescient in that sense. But coming back to the fiscal cliff, it's political theatre. We all know what the deal will be cut. The deal will be we won't resolve anything. Obama will agree to some sort of concessions on social welfare, which will be the indexation part. Some of the benefits won't be indexed. Secondly, on the other side, on the taxation side, the Republicans will give way. But essentially, nobody will deal with the issue of the budget deficit because it's too hard. And then I think the next thing that comes from that is that America is now in permanent electioneering mode because everybody's positioning from the midterms and the next presidential run. So nothing's going to be done there.
The five of us are all involved in good old-fashioned mainstream media. I'd like to round off the program by remembering it's been the most turbulent year for newspapers, for journalism, in history. Do you have any optimism, Dennis, that we're going to linger on as a force for good?
Yes, I do. I've got some optimism that we will linger on, and I think linger is probably a good word. Things are not going to be the same, and I work for News Limited. We saw that last week where because we're putting in a new technological way of producing our newspapers next year, we're going to actually have to shrink our workforce yet again. This comes just a couple of months after we had a pretty major shrinkage of the workforce. Doing more with less is sort of the buzz phrase in newspapers. Trying to work out how to make money out of newspapers is a huge challenge. I mean, some of the newspapers in Australia, which people would think should be money going concerns, are struggling to break even at the moment. And how we get into the next phase of mass-produced information which we've known in the past as the thing that comes across the front lawn in the morning is the big question that everybody in my industry, our industry, is facing. What we do, I don't know. No one has got a silver bullet, but I do have some optimism that, you know, the people are still reading. The problem is they're not paying for it as much as they used to. To reconcile those two things, it's probably the most difficult thing that people have faced since Gutenberg did away with the town criers.
I won't ask you about the upsurge of optimism at Fairfax, Laura. What I will ask you instead is to give me a feeling about or what do you hope to see in the year ahead?
Philip, I'd like us to evolve to the point where we can have some sort of rational debate about what we expect of government. Whether that happens or not, given the mud and guts and disgustingness of 2012, it's hard to say, but it should be possible. And it needs to be possible because, for all the reasons we've discussed tonight, the world economy is in a slowing transformation. We're in this sort of bizarre situation where we all think Australia is in a really bad state, but we're actually a safe haven economy for the rest of the world at the moment. That's damaging us. But I think that if you have some intelligent political leadership, she said optimistically, we can actually have a really good debate about what government should do for us.
What are you praying for, Paul?
I'm praying, Philip, that we start to take our environment seriously, that we start to take seriously the question of global warming, that we are prepared to make the sacrifices that that will involve, and that we have a government that is able to articulate some really significant environmental goals within our future. So I'm on my knees now, Philip.
What about you, Dus?
I'm just hoping the Mayan calendar is wrong.
Very amusing. Look, thank you, dear panel. It's been good to mingle again with Tingle, Laura, political editor with The Fin, Dennis Atkins, national affairs editor with the Brisbane Courier-Mail, Satyajit Das, former banker, author and economics whiz, and Dr. Paul Collins, my personal priest, author and broadcaster. Thanks to you all. I'll be back live in January next year for year 22. Until then, I hope you enjoy our special repeats and profferings over summer. Please don't forget to visit the In Bed with Philip website to catch up with some of the LNL classics from the past 21 years. Good on you, Gail. And you can still follow me on Twitter @PhilipAdamsABC. Stick around for the news, and bye for now.